Chapter 11, Prisoners to Prophets, March 1961, Harvard University. By spring, we'd given psychedelic drugs to over 200 subjects. We'd learned a lot about how to run sessions. 85% of our subjects were reporting that the experience was the most educational of their lives, and these testimonies were especially pleasing because most therapies, as you know, including psychoanalysis, traditionally reported around 33% positive change. But as scientists, we were still dissatisfied. We were faced with the unavoidable problem in the field of psychology or psychiatry. How? How do you demonstrate that someone has improved? Self-appraisals are an important index, but they're inconclusive. Heroin addicts and born-again Christians both claim to feel better, but others might disagree. There didn't seem to be an objective, ballpark way of keeping score on life changes. Half the people might have loosened up and half might have gotten their lives more tightly organized. And for any or all of them, the changes might have been a genuine improvement. Half might have increased the intimacy and closeness of their marriages. And half might have left their spouses. Some might have benefited by making more money, some by making less. We needed clear statistical indices like batting averages for the game of life. Just at this time, a call came from two officials of the Massachusetts prison system. They requested that a Harvard graduate intern be assigned for research and training. They expected a quick turndown. Just as prison guards were the bottom of the law enforcement hierarchy, prison work was at that time the pits of psychology. Criminals simply did not change. Much to their surprise, I invited the prison officials over for lunch. I welcome the chance to get into a prison and start a volunteer rehabilitation program. I had two purposes in mind. One, if we could change the behavior of violent criminals with our drugs, we could demonstrate that our methods and theories worked where nothing else did. Second, prison rehabilitation could provide us with a behavioral scientist's dream, an ironclad objective index of improvement, the recidivism rate. Now, the return rate in Massachusetts prisons was running 70%. I knew we could decimate that percentage. And what a boon to society, converting violent criminals to law-abiding citizens. If we could teach the most unregenerate how to wash their own brains, then it would be a cinch to coach non-criminals to change their lives for the better. Or in any case, let's find out. So a deal was cut over lunch. I agreed to send Harvard graduate interns into the prisons. The officials agreed to get clearances from the wardens and the psychiatrists for us to give and take drugs to and with the convicts. Six prisoners and three Harvard psychologists met for the first drug session. During the morning, I was to turn on with three convicts. The three other prisoners and the two graduate students would act as observers. Then, in the afternoon, the students, Gunther Wilde and Ralph Metzner, and the three observing prisoners would take the drug, and our first group would act as guides. We brought a record player, a tape recorder, and several books of classical art with us. Otherwise, the room was pretty bleak. Four beds, large table, and a few chairs. The bowl of pills was placed in the center of the table. To establish trust, I was the first to ingest. Then the bowl was passed among the three prisoners, each of whom took 20 milligrams. After a half hour, the effect started coming on, the familiar loosening of thought, the humming pressure in my head, the sharp, brilliant, and then brutal intensification of the senses. I felt terrible. What a place to be, locked in a penitentiary, out of light, out of mind. I turned my brain towards the man next to me, a Polish bank robber from Worcester. I could see him much too clearly. Every pore in his face, every blemish, the hairs in his nose, the horrid green-yellow enamel of his decaying teeth, the glistening of his frightened eyes. Every hair in his head was looking as big as a tree branch. What am I doing here? How you doing, John? I asked with a weak grin. I feel fine, he answered, but I didn't believe him. How are you doing, Doc? I was about to reply in a reassuring, professional tone, but I couldn't do it. It's kind of hard to lie when you're in the power of the mushroom. I feel lousy, John. John drew back his purple-pink lips. Hey, what's the matter, Doc? Inside his eyes, I could see a yellow spider web of retinal fibers, optical veins shining and pulsing. I'm afraid of you, John, I said. John's eyes enlarged, and then he began to laugh. I could see right into his mouth, swollen red tissues, gums, tongue, throat. I was about to be swallowed. Well, that's funny, Doc, because I'm afraid of you. We were both smiling at this point, leaning forward. Yeah? Why are you afraid of me, Doc? I'm afraid of you, John, because you're a criminal. Why are you afraid of me? I'm afraid of you, Doc, because you're a fucking mad scientist. Then our eyes locked, and we both laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed. Voila! There it was. We'd made that connection. The sun suddenly came out in the room. For a while. Then one of the prisoners, the black heroin pusher, moaned and started tossing on his cot. My God, are you all right, Willie? I was apprehensive about a potential threat to our newfound sense of security. Believe me, everyone in the room was watching, anxiously wondering if the prison setting was just irretrievably wrong. Was this going to be one of those dreaded bad trips? Then Willie lifted his head and he shot me the big, big grin. He said, man, am I all right? I'm in heaven, looking down on this funny little planet, and I'm a million years old, and there's a million things to me enjoy every second, and it's all happening in prison, and you ask me, man, am I all right? When Willie laughed, we were all high and happy. At 6 o'clock, as the afternoon session was winding down, there was this bang on the door. The guards came in. Time is up, men. Back to your ward. Ralph, Gunther, and I went with the six prisoners back to the lockup part of the hospital where we smoked and laughed and compared notes on what we'd seen and where we'd been. Then it was time for us Harvards to leave. We shook hands. I promised to return the very next day for a follow-up. Ralph, Gunther, and I walked out of the hospital, across the dark prison yard, rang the bell, and waited until the iron doors opened to the guard room. We went through two metal doors, down metal steps, past the clanking, steaming radiators, and outside the prison. We laughed and laughed in triumph. All of us, Harvardites and convicts, had passed a crucial test. We'd put our faith in human nature and the drug experience right on the line. A little bit of pagan magic had occurred, and none of us would ever forget that brief day of grace. It was a heroic moment in all of our lives. The morning after the session, driving back to the prison was like returning to some comfortable place in my skull. Strong bonds of empathy had developed. Hey, we'd been through an adventure together. We'd gone beyond the roles of Harvard psychologist and dangerous criminal, faced fear together, had trusted and laughed. This time, you know, I felt at home in the prison. It tends to work this way after a good trip. Your old reality fades a bit and you incorporate a new reality. This identification is not metaphorical. It is neurological. In scientific papers, we call this process re-imprinting. We spent the next 2 weeks discussing the prisoners' reactions. Then we ran a second session for the same group. This time, the prisoners were more sophisticated. There was no sitting around on chairs in nervous anticipation. As soon as the energy began to radiate through their bodies, they headed for the cots, closed their eyes. For the next 2 or 3 hours, they lay there, engulfed in the visions, occasionally sitting to smile or make some quiet comment. After the third session, the convicts repeated the personality test to measure changes in their behavior and in their thinking. We brought the test results back into the hospital room, and we handed them to the inmates. There were no more secrets. We explained what the tests measure and what the results seemed to mean. The prisoners had changed on the objective indices so dear to the heart of the scientific psychologist. They showed less depression, less hostility, less antisocial tendency, more energy, more responsibility, and much more cooperation. Their personality scores, in other words, had swung dramatically and significantly in the direction of so-called improved mental health. By handing over and explaining their test results honestly with them, we were training the prisoners in frontline, street-smart psychodiagnostics. The prisoners were becoming their own psychologists. They sensed this, and they loved it. Hey, there were fierce discussions about personality characteristics as the cons played the psychiatry game. Then we planned the next phase of the research. The convicts were to select new recruits for the group. They, the prisoners, would learn how to administer the tests. They would give the orientation lectures. They would start to take over the project. The prison became a training center. New graduate students were assigned to experienced inmates for orientation and guidance. In session after session, the inmates guided the Harvards, and the Harvards guided the convicts. The energy generated by these sessions was felt far beyond the prison walls. The penitentiary session room became a showplace. Whenever visitors came to Cambridge inquiring about psychedelic drugs, we tended to take them out to the prison. The convicts spoke about their mystical experiences to Gerald Hurd and to William Burroughs and to Alan Watts and Aldous Huxley and the ex-King of Sarawak, you name it, as well as to coveys and troops of visiting psychiatrists. Now hear this. Our strategy was to do everything possible to enhance the pride and sense of accomplishment. Every power we could turn over to the convicts became a fiber in the body of their self-esteem. By the fall of 1962, we had over 35 convicts and 15 Harvards in this group. The men started to be paroled by this time at the rate of two or three a month, so we started up Project Contact. The ex-cons and the Harvards were paired up in buddy system teams, with the Harvards visiting the ex-cons in their homes. We sobered them up, we praised them to the parole officers, we cooled out their angry bosses. In short, we did what a family does for its confused members, and we kept him out of jail. Soon our circus had grown into a three-ring extravaganza. There was the in-prison group, there was the outside contact project, and there was the equally important task of keeping the state administrators and officials happy. One morning in the second year of the project, I came into Warden Grennan's office to report the most recent statistics. We had kept 90% of our convicts out of jail. The warden listened politely, but he kept glancing behind me. When I finished my triumphant report, he clapped me on the back and led me around to the corner of the room. "Look at that, Timmy," he said proudly. It was an architect's color drawing of the super prison. "Look, two football fields. This wing is for admitting and orientation. Two more cell blocks. Mess hall's doubled in size. We'll have capacity for twice as many inmates, and we can double the staff all the way down the line." The warden's face was glowing. This was his fantasy coming true. Enormous prison, and an organization table twice as big to go with it. Bureaucrat heaven. "That's wonderful, Bill," I said, "but you've forgotten. You're not going to need a larger prison." His face registered surprise. "Why not?" "Well, Warden, have you forgotten? We're cutting your return rate from 70% to 10%. If you let us continue this project, you won't need half the cells you have right now." The warden laughed in spite of himself. "I can't argue with you, Timmy. You've kept these men straight, although I'll be goddamned if I know how you did it." We were trying to figure this out ourselves. Imprinting is a form of permanent learning assimilated in one shot, as opposed to step-by-step, painstaking, and often painful punishment-reward conditioning. Lorenz discovered the imprinting phenomena one day when goose eggs hatched in an incubator in his laboratory. In the absence of the mother, the goslings followed him around, apparently because he was the only warm, moving object on the scene. Hundreds of experiments by Lorenz and others have demonstrated that this immediate learning, which requires no reward or punishment, occurs only during a critical period, shortly after birth or metamorphosis, when the brain and the mind is open to change. During this critical period, the organism, rather than acquiring behavior from the environment, hooks up an innate behavior pattern to the environment. Psychologists were at first reluctant to apply the imprinting principle to human behavior, probably because of the challenge it posed to our notion of free will. However, the dramatic changes in behavior that followed our prison experiments seem to be best explained by these concepts. The drugs appeared to suspend previous imprints of reality, in this case, the prison mentality, inducing a critical period during which new imprints could be made. People tended to form powerful, positive attachments to those present during a trip, sometimes following each other around like Lorenz's goslings. It was also true that I was becoming attached to those present during my sessions. In a positive, supportive environment, new non-criminal realities were being imprinted by the convicts. And in some weird, spooky, and ominous way, I may have been imprinting and re-imprinting a prison mentality, a reality which I was forced to inhabit between 1970 and 1976. Everything that I have learned in the subsequent 29 years of drug research has strengthened my conviction that psychedelic reimprinting ranks with DNA deciphering as one of the most significant discoveries of our century.